This is the Benson at 100, a podcast from the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. The Benson is one of the world's most storied libraries. During this, our centennial year, we explore the people, archives, and collections that built this library. Learn more at benson100.org. That's benson100.org. Thanks for joining us.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Benson at 100 podcast. I'm your host, Pilar Zazueta. I'm a historian and the associate director of Lilas Benson, Latin American Studies and Collections at the University of Texas at Austin. Joining me today is my co-host, Daniel Arvino, head of collection development for the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection. Welcome, Daniel.
Hey, Pilar. It's good to be back for another episode. And this one feels especially fun, doesn't it?
Yes. Do you think we should tell the audience why?
We have to.
It's because it's our fifth episode, but our first time recording it together in person.
And not just anywhere, either.
That's right. We're in a studio.
Yes. I'm really excited about this because it will be the first time we don't have to worry about one of our dogs going crazy over a delivery person while we're in the middle of recording.
Yes, that happened a lot.
Yeah. So what should we talk about today? I feel like the world is our oyster.
Daniel, today we should talk about a recent digital exhibition that you did to commemorate the Benson Centennial. It's called A Hemisphere of Knowledge. Can you tell us about the inspiration for this project?
Definitely. I was tasked with coming up with the idea for a digital exhibition around November of 2020. Now, generally speaking, digital exhibitions have been around for years. In some ways, their goals are to do what the physical exhibition at a museum or library set out to do, take unique objects and put them on a display in some thematic way to both educate and attract audiences. Digital exhibits merely do this in the virtual space, and that has its benefits, the most relevant one being that you can reach larger audiences and from different parts of the world, right? And given that we're the Latin American, the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection, we want to reach our patrons in Latin America for sure. A digital exhibit can live on the internet a little longer than a physical exhibit can live in a library as well, as long as the server space and the technology are maintained. So that's working for us too.
So it's almost forever.
Right.
That makes sense. I would imagine that the pandemic exacerbating the use of digital exhibits.
Yeah, you're spot on. The Benson always planned to have a physical and digital exhibit for the centennial, two distinct topics. But because the pandemic essentially closed public spaces, we focused on connecting with our patrons through the digital realm in the short term. In those cases, we create what are called digital surrogates, or high-resolution scans, if you will, of the materials that we want to use in the digital exhibit. There's surprisingly a lot that goes into it. You have to create data for each item as well so that the materials are well-described and the term we use in the library world, discoverable. And it's not just the exhibit I did, but you can see it in our output elsewhere. For instance, Albert Palacios, our digital scholarship coordinator, has an incredible exhibit on Mexico's colonial period called A New Spain, as one example.
I'll be sure to check that one out. So tell us a bit about your exhibit, A Hemisphere of Knowledge. Walk us through your early ideas.
I wanted to do something thematic so that I could pull from different collections in unique ways, right? I had landed on two ideas. One was guided by the progression of time. It focused on pre-Columbian all the way to modern day. So there would have been sections on the colonial period that talked about the formation of the self and other and how that binary quickly becomes complicated and blurry. Then I was going to move into nationhood and finally that post-World War II leftist turn that ultimately runs into neoliberalism and globalization. That's how I remember it anyway.
And why did you choose not to do that particular exhibit?
It felt like the story had been told too many times. This is a story that emerges from genocide and violence where success was measured on a battlefield. I didn't want to tell a story that was guided by Western concepts of progress and modernity necessarily. That version of history has to be there, but I wanted to see what could happen if other stories were also privileged.
Yes, I see why you wanted to step out of this model that we inherited in part from the European Enlightenment. This idea that each historical era, I'm quoting here German philosopher Hegel, for example, that each era embodied some aspect or stage in the development of the mind of humanity. In other words, a way of seeing history as rational, a process with a beginning, a middle, and even an end. So I also see your strategy to try to get away from something like bronze history, la historia de bronce. That's the way we call it in Mexico. And what I mean by that is this nationalistic history that is not really about curiosity, but about indoctrination. So what kind of story do you want to tell instead?
Exactly. I still wanted to engage with power and how it plays out. And I think to ignore it would be irresponsible on my part. But I wanted to do it through knowledge and knowledge production throughout the hemisphere. My goal was to honor traditional knowledge alongside other forms and to poke at Eurocentric ideas. I organized the exhibit around six themes: 1, medicine; 2, land, flora, and fauna; 3, subsistence and harvest; 4, reading the sky for signs; 5, handicrafts; and 6, community stories and songs, all while considering the lasting effects of colonialism, imperialism, and neoliberalism.
And what was your inspiration for this focus on knowledge?
Well, at the time I was reading Decolonizing Museums by historian and Ho-Chunk citizen Amy Lone Tree. I wouldn't say my exhibition is decolonial, but the book was a real inspiration for me to think about how I wanted to highlight Benson materials while also framing a discussion around them that looked at history and culture. I've also been a longtime fan of reggae music. This is through my mom. And I like that the genre mocks Western knowledge and constantly pokes at it as a form of oppression for non-European peoples. You know, I think Western society has this desire to be able to explain everything. And as a result, we delegitimize concepts that we can't explain. We'll call another culture's belief a superstition, in between air quotes there, because we don't understand it. And in that way, we devalue it. But the truth is, historically, there hasn't been an effort to understand, and that's bred ignorance. That's something I think about a lot because I wonder what would happen if these different forms of knowledge could complement each other instead of be in opposition. Do you kind of know what I mean?
Yes. So this idea of different knowledges complementing each other made me think about agroecology, which is both a science and a set of practices. There are a lot of communities in Latin America who adhere to agroecological principles. So as a science, for those who are unfamiliar with agroecology, it consists of the application of ecological science to the study, design, and management of food production. But it's not just purely technical knowledge delivered top-down from experts to farmers. Agroecology is developed on the basis of farmers' and communities' own traditions and experimentation. So producing food using agroecological principles works with the understanding that there is not a single way of knowing, as you were saying, and that you cannot aim to control everything or predict every single thing in farming. You know, kind of what you were talking about when you mentioned reggae, no? Right. Letting go of trying to control all of the process.
Right.
And speaking about the process of creation and cultivation, what challenges did you encounter while curating the exhibition?
Yeah, well, we've talked about this before, but the Benson has a lot of materials.
Hello.
And to go through so much stuff was fun, and I had a lot of help, but I always wonder if I overlook something. Then, of course, I worry a lot about representation. I could have brought in more Afro-Latin American representation, more indigenous representation. Not every country in Latin America is represented. And so there's always that space for improvement, because I really want people to see this exhibition and have something, even if it's only one image, that resonates with them.
Yes, it's a challenge. You will necessarily overlook or leave something out. It's impossible not to. But it is important to be intentional, as you mentioned, and reflexive about what you're creating. You did draw from a very wide variety of sources, and you ended up with six topics, as you mentioned. And I want to talk about two. First, land, flora, and fauna. And second, subsistence and harvest.
For sure. It only makes sense to talk about harvest during the autumn months. Here in Austin, the mornings are a little cooler, right? Do you have a personal or professional interest in those two themes?
Yes, I do. I have written about the history of nutritional sciences in Mexico and teach a class about food politics in Latin America. What about you?
That sounds super interesting. I've had an interest in food studies from a literary perspective for a while. And so to me, it was a natural fit to talk about traditional production and cultural connections to food in contrast to the massive production that happens now. Post-colonial thinker Frantz Fanon referred to a secondary definition of assimilation. We all know the idea that assimilation is taking on another culture, oftentimes to the detriment of your own. But he also talks about how it is the notion of absorbing food and digesting it. To me, it makes for an interesting study of how food plays out on our identities, like this notion that you are what you eat. And if you think about the importance of corn in Mesoamerica, the very notion of hombres de maíz, that's such a strong part of the Maya belief system, you realize that the expression has real value. The other idea for me is that people are deeply connected to their land, their local ecosystem, and any sort of crop production. And those people often have encyclopedic knowledge of these topics, even though we might not consider them, quote unquote, intellectuals in the academic sense, right? And so we need to recognize that knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. And in the section about subsistence and harvest, you pay homage to local cuisines and their fight for survival against colonial and imperial designs. And this made me think about the stories of manioc, cassava, and corn, maíz, and how these products were transported from the Americas and adopted as staple foods in many parts of the world. However, the knowledge involved in the cooking of these foods made with cassava or corn did not travel. I suspect that you have eaten tortillas, corn tortillas, I don't know, or even prepared tamales.
Yes.
But what about any foods prepared with cassava or manioc?
Yeah, so my taco tummy has given me away here.
He doesn't have one.
Of course, the tamalada is an event at my in-law's house each December. It's this beautiful moment to see three generations of family working together to maintain a tradition and also make the world's very best tamales. But cassava, I've only dabbled in a little bit. Some Brazilian cuisine, they sprinkle the flour type atop the feijoada. Some Caribbean cuisine, but I don't know it as well. So, of course, this means we should talk about it. Let's talk about cassava.
Exactly. Let's make everybody hungry. So manioc or cassava, it's a tuber, in case people don't know what we're talking about. And there are, in fact, many varieties of this crop. It is very sturdy and it can be cultivated in drought-prone tropical ecosystems. The problem with cassava is that it can cause both acute and chronic cyanide poisoning. And
wow.
That sounds as really bad, and it is.
Yes.
The trick is that you can eat the cassava and it tastes fine, but if you do not process it correctly, you slowly get poisoned.
Ooh, boy. Okay, so how do you prevent this poisoning?
So there are multiple processes that indigenous people, for example, in the Amazons, have developed over centuries. One example, in the Colombian Amazon, the indigenous Tucanoans use a multi-step, multi-day processing technique that involves scraping, grating, and finally washing the roots in order to separate the fiber, starch, and liquid. Once separated, they use the liquid as a beverage, and the fiber and the starch can be baked and eaten. However, a single person would have a very difficult time figuring out how to detoxify the cassava. Mm. So it's a slow community-based production of knowledge,
wow,
which can also be passed from generation to generation.
And just to clarify, this is what you're saying did not travel to other places. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. In the beginning of the 17th century, the Portuguese transported manioc or cassava from South America to West Africa. They did not, however, adopt or learn the cooking and processing techniques.
It makes you really have to trust the person preparing your cassava, right?
Exactly. And there are places where cyanide poisoning for a very long time before we figured this out. Right. It was something that happened to people.
Wow, incredible. Well, the same thing happened with corn. When Europeans brought corn to Europe, they did not adopt the nixtamalization process. This process is cooking corn kernels in an alkaline medium to obtain fresh corn dough or nixtamalized corn flour, which enhances the nutritional quality of the grain, and it releases niacin or vitamin B3 from the maize, corn, or maíz, whichever you prefer. And this is what happens at my in-laws' house when they put me to work grinding corn to make tamales.
Exactly. You're making the corn more nutritious.
Right.
I bet you were thinking about that while you're grinding the corn. So if you do not process the corn this way, there are risks. In Italy, for example, people ate corn without processing it this way and developed an endemic form of niacin deficiency. The disease is called pellagra. Mm. It was caused in most cases by an exclusive prolonged diet of boiled cornmeal called polenta, which is actually pretty good. Do you like polenta?
I love it, but now I'm nervous about it. And it happened both ways with food, right? Some food moved to other countries, like the potato from the Andean region to Ireland, yet other crops were shunned. I'm thinking of amaranth, which the Spaniards banned because of its ceremonial uses in Mesoamerica.
Well, but I want to go back a bit to some of the sources that you chose for the exhibit. Do you want to focus on a particular source?
Yeah, well, all of this talk about food is making me hungry. I worry that the audience will hear my stomach growling through the podcast, but why don't we focus on Catalina Delgado Trunk's Papel Picado piece, Corazón del Cacao. Papel picado is a popular art that uses an X-Acto knife and extremely thin tissue paper called papel de China or China paper. The X-Acto knife creates an image through negative space by chiseling out parts of the paper. Delgado Trunk has taken this popular art form and elevated it to a fine art, and Corazón del Cacao is no exception. As a side note, I should mention the Benson added Catalina Delgado Trunk's papers in 2018, and it was just a monumental occasion for me to get to work with her and know her a little bit better. I really view it as one of the great advantages of my job. But anyway, focusing on Corazón del Cacao, the piece is a visual rendering of the importance of chocolate within Mesoamerican culture. This is another one of those foods whose taste and meaning has been transformed within a larger world system, right?
Absolutely, as you said. And the colonizers tried to ban chocolate as well, but they were unsuccessful. Chocolate comes from the fruit of the cacao tree. The fruit is called a pod, and each fruit contains around 3 dozen beans in it. And those beans are the ones that you dry and roast right to prepare chocolate. And the research indicates that the Olmecs, one of the earliest Mesoamerican cultures, used cacao beans as a drink as early as 1900 BC.
Wow.
It's also been shown that the Maya and the Aztecs also drank chocolate. And in fact, there is evidence pointing to chocolate consumption among the Chaco Canyon peoples of New Mexico, which suggests that an immense trade network that developed over time.
Yeah.
So, they were producing the cacao in tropical areas and getting it to New Mexico,
right,
which is quite incredible.
Right. And one detail that you keep mentioning is that chocolate was being consumed as a drink.
Yes, that's true. But that's not all. There are accounts that the drinks often contain hints of chile or peanut in them too.
And have you ever tried one of these chocolates with the chile?
I have. Actually, it was a gift from a student who was taking one of my food culture classes here at UT.
Yeah. did you like it?
I did. It was spicy.
Yeah.
I like spicy drinks.
Me too. This is very different from how we might think of the mass-produced chocolate of today.
We think of chocolate today usually as something sweet and in solid form. For instance, the chocolate bar. Everybody likes chocolate bars. But history shows that chocolate was typically a bitter drink. It was sweetened with the help of large-scale sugar production to better satisfy the tastes of Europeans.
That's one of the big changes for sure. In that process, I imagine that meaning was lost too. I'm looking at this piece by Delgado Trunk, who was born in Mexico City, currently resides in New Mexico, and also a University of Texas alum, by the way. I should throw that out there. And I see what looks like a deity emerging from a very detailed and richly decorated vessel.
Yes, the whole piece is very beautiful and rather intricate. On the borders, you can see the cacao pots. You also have a visual representation of someone grinding the cacao into a powder within one of these vessels. And to your point, the emergence of the god speaks to the ceremonial uses of chocolate. It was greatly revered in Mesoamerican cultures. Mm-hmm. And was often drunk during important community celebration, religious or otherwise, or to finalize commercial transactions. You could use the cacao beans as a currency too. So chocolate was consumed and appreciated by all classes in indigenous society.
It has a deep history, and I think that's what's so fascinating about crops is that humankind's relationship to them often spans centuries. It puts so much into perspective.
Yes. So now that we made everybody hungry, including ourselves, so let's keep in mind the next time you're drinking a cup of chocolate, maybe the Abuelita brand that is very popular in Mexico and in the southwest of the U.S. And as always, thank you for tuning in into our latest episode of the Benson at 100s. We hope you enjoyed talking food, and please join us next time. Bye-bye, Daniel.
Bye. Thanks, everyone.
The Benson at 100 is a production of Lilas Benson Latin American Studies and Collections at the University of Texas at Austin. To see relevant images and links for today's discussion, as well as to support the Benson Centennial, visit benson100.org. Music for this podcast was composed by Ola Ola. Thanks for tuning in.